Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock for the last 100 Wednesdays. Actually, there's probably a few more Wednesdays in there, but 100 episodes. This is our 100th episode. We have helped you engage in a conversation about food by using taste as the sort of framing concept to talk about so many interesting and enlightening aspects about our food culture. And we're so grateful to you, our listeners, who have joined us for the previous 99 episodes and who are with us for the 100th. And as a special tribute on this interesting day, it's 9/11 here in New York. Actually, it's 9/11 everywhere, except maybe in a few places across the dateline. And of course, that's a resonant time of year for those of us in New York City and around the world. And we thought we would, for our 100th episode on this day, bring into the studio some people you've heard from over the last 2 years of programming as our guest hosts and sometimes guests, Isabella Wojcik, who is the director of house programming at the James Beard Foundation, where we work, the person responsible for scheduling, planning, menu, crafting, conceiving, thinking, naming the 200 plus events a year that we do at the Beard House. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm exhausted just listening to that.
Yes, and she comes bearing gifts, so careful. If we're good, maybe we'll get a rum ball before she leaves. And also with us is Karen Karp, who you have heard from several times in that previous 100 episodes, who is the founder and president of Karp Resources, which is a consultancy that addresses so many different aspects of food, including sort of large policy issues, food systems issues, supply chain things, cool ideas, and helps us at the Beard Foundation plan our annual James Beard Foundation Food Conference and other sustainable-related programs. So welcome.
Pleasure, Karen, to be here, as always.
It's nice to have you on the other side. We're not always in the studio together. In fact, often we're opposite. And also with us is Ashley Koziak, who is the person who makes this show happen, one of our producers and also on our team at the Beard Foundation. And we're grateful to have her here to chat about the last 99 and a half episodes.
Hi.
So, this is a funny show. And in preparation for it, we realized that we could have taken the sort of, I don't know what you would call it, high programming approach and gone back into the archives and found snippets of conversations we've loved and funny ha-has and guffaws and chat-chats that we've had. But instead, because we're not really that together and we all have other very busy things to do, we thought that we would talk about or reflect on together the last couple of years from our unique perspectives that we represent here. And Isabella's representing, from her purview at the Beard Foundation, representing the sort of all of what's going on in American food and gastronomy, at least as it comes to her desk. And believe me, it comes through the phone and through email and through all sorts of other means. And Karen, from this perspective of an increasing awareness of chefs and increasing engagement in some of these bigger food system issues that have been happening for a long time around the gastronomic community, let's say, but are ever more at the forefront of the way people think about what it is, how they want to participate in the food world these days in America. So let's just start with Isabella, and let's ask, like, what have you seen in the last couple of years that you think are trends or even interests emerging in chefs and the food that they serve and the things that they're interested in presenting?
Sure, and if you don't mind, I just wanted to go back maybe even a decade, just okay, super fine. Quick to set a tone. So 10 years ago, or even 11 years ago, what we were thinking about is really El Bulli. That was really, that wasn't the start of El Bulli's impact, but that was certainly what was percolating throughout the whole country. So explain a little bit
about what that is.
Of course. So this Seminole restaurant since recently closed, but it was very technique driven and it put Spain and modernist thinking and looking outside of the box in terms of how food should look, taste, be textured, be temperatured, breaking not just rules that had been established in terms of presentation, but it's seemingly breaking the rules of science and how things are created. And so chefs around the globe were very interested in that, mimicked it, copied it. So there was techniques coming through, and this idea of farm to table was also very new and exciting. And I remember my first few events, 10 years ago, I actually called them farm to table because they were such a standout that there was some farm being connected and some, you know, number of chards being represented in one of the courses. Those are the early years. And what's been happening in the last decade, and then I'll get to what's been happening last 2 years, is both techniques have been, you know, discarded, tried, retested, rethought. So that idea of innovation. And what happened to farm to table is definitely a backlash from chefs, from consumers, from writers even, about this silly notion. First, we like ran to the farmers markets. We overpaid for the same 7 things within the season. And then the chefs who have always been cooking from the farm, because where else was it coming from, you know, 50 years ago, but not the farm. So that we've moved away from this idea of what farm to table was. And the next wave of cooking and thinking about food from a professional chef perspective that I'm seeing at the Beard House, I'm seeing around, that consumers are being impacted by, is less the technique and more about foraging, talking about leaving behind the technique in the background, it's still there, talking about where the ingredients are coming from, and this, you know, this kind of pioneer thinking about foraging for what is really indigenous that didn't seem edible before, maybe, that seemed like a weed or seemed like an oddball sea monster thing. And I'm seeing, and that impact, we left Spain in referencing El Bulli and went straight to Denmark and Noma and Chef Rene Redzepi, but many others since that have left that kitchen and opened very like-minded places around the world. And that has gotten us thinking about, well, what's really growing indigenously in our own backyard. So we've left the idea of seasonal cooking, and now we're into this really indigenous and seasonal to really represent the geography, the topography, the culture, the history, the root, the root of it all. So we're in this moment in time where diners are seeing the food, the names of ingredients, things that didn't seem edible before, but also the way that they're being plated. It's much more botanical. It's much more, it looks like the bottom of your, you know, a geranium or an arboretum or a forest. So the presentations are very exciting. So we're in this moment of really exploring these ingredients. And what I'm seeing, again, being this wave that is very new, I'm feeling, in terms of how chefs are thinking, is this word of community. And then I'll turn it over to you, because I think it's a big word that ties in lots of things that we wanted to talk about today. But chefs are thinking about community in terms of their own restaurant as a business at the center, and how that is placed within that community, that town, that village, how it's the community of their own employees, their own staff, their own family members, how their location and how their mere existence is impacting. And they're looking at it as this sort of ecosystem, and they're thinking about their diners, they're thinking about power, they're thinking about roles, they're thinking about issues, and health and nutrition certainly is coming into play where it really wasn't a factor before in good food and in fine dining and in restaurants. I'm seeing chefs really being concerned about their well-being, of their own well-being, their staff, the health of their community. So this community as an idea is very big now.
Okay, that's a lot to chew on. Thank you. And let's turn it over to Karen and talk about the sense of community, and also the political and citizen participation and what that might mean.
Sure. And I guess, you know, Isabel, you've said all of that very eloquently about the evolution of some of these trends. And it's true. And I'll kind of go back to the local food trend where it was 10 years ago, not on the restaurant side, but sort of on the side of the food chain that we function a lot on, which is on the producer side and the aggregators and the distributors and all those unsexy links in the chain. And
I've met some sexy aggregators. I don't know. Anyway.
And it's absolutely true. I mean, one of the first projects we worked on in this sort of local food, you know, kind of early part of the wave was research to establish the viability of establishing a wholesale farmers market in New York City, specifically to address that problem of chefs going to Union Square or another green market and buying, you know, four of X, you know, number of products and carrying it back on a hand truck or in a baby carriage or whatever, you know, very kind of unsanitary methods of transporting food.
Unsanitary and inefficient. There's the joke on Wednesday that all the chefs have to go stop by the green market so people see them there, but actually no one can buy anything there because they need it in quantities that are not for sale.
Right. And Mitchell kind of knows that, you know, going back 4 or 5 years, I had this sort of groaning impatience about local food being the definition of sustainability among chefs. And I think one of the things that's really evolved over the last, now I'm going to take it from 10 years to 4 years to today, is just exactly what you said, is that chefs, restaurateurs, retailers, wholesalers, folks that run institutional food service companies like catering companies, school organizations, etc., are really stopping to look at what is on the plate and how did it get there and how does that whole thing that's on the plate, how was the community that put that food together and got it here? How is everybody impacted by virtue of being in that relationship with each other? And in fact, even in some of the work that we're doing now to quantify demand for local food in other places, because the sort of notion of local food being able to be aggregated and scaled up to meet the demand for in the wholesale sector, the number one reason businesses are telling us that they're interested in buying more local food today is very different from 10 years ago. Today, what they're saying is, because I want to have an impact in this community. I want to employ people here. I want to employ people in the region, and I want the agriculture community in the surrounding area to this city. I want them to be thriving. That sense of kind of relationship and responsibility was not there at first when it was the let's get that first heirloom tomato on our plate. So there's really been a nice evolution there.
And well, fascinating. And I guess part of what I wonder is what is the role of the gastronome in this. So what I mean by that is you've both described a change, a sense that restaurants were perhaps a place for the connoisseur, let's say, or the person who could afford to participate at a certain level. But the notion of community, the sense of responsibility and an accountability for a business enterprise and ingredients and the people involved in the chain, let's say, brings the idea of a restaurant out of the highest lofty levels of only those who can afford it, le pavillon of its day, let's say, and puts it in other places. And yet there's still an economic consequence. People have to be able, one imagines, to afford. We talk a lot about the affordability of some of the food produced and distributed based on the principles that we're talking about. But what is the role of taste and flavor and what are the matters of taste, let's say, from both of your perspectives in this shift?
So from my perspective, let's see, and not just thinking about the Beard House, because the Beard House certainly is at a certain price point. So I think it very much represents indulging and taking the time and taking the care, whether it's once or, you know, often. But what I see happening is really the there's definitely that wall still about how much you're willing to spend for an experience. I think the change in the restaurants has been there's a growing kind of mid-sector, not the super cheap ethnic eats, but the slightly more expensive yet still approachable factor. And I think that makes restaurants seem more approachable, seem more proletarian, even if they're not. I think the responsibility on the diner is, you know, if you buy all those little plates and you get in all those cocktails, then it's going to be an extremely expensive experience. And so the approachability, I think, is the reputation of the restaurants, small plates, more approachable kind of food. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, the fine dining is still there.
You're making me think of David Chang, a recent guest, who's mm-hmm. who sort of, you know, finds himself on the list of the world's 50 best restaurants. But when you think of the rock and roll, you know, $12-16 dish in his sambar or something, you don't exactly think of that. But is there a so is that bringing more people in, do you think, or is it just allowing more people to play in this elevated game? Is there some democratization happening there, or is it just a perception?
Both. I think that, my feeling is that the perception is changed because diners, consumers are cooking more, or they're sort of, you know, taking on the habit or maybe hobby. But I feel like, particularly living in New York City or a big city, it's very expensive. So there's economics involved. But I think it's also, it's entertainment. It's fun. It's trendy. It's trendy to be into food, especially if you don't work in the business. So I see a lot more food experiences happening that are at a different price point. So I guess I'm not really answering your question well, but I'm trying to say is the shape of restaurants has changed. Mm-hmm. So you do still have the super fine dining price point, even though the super fine dining experience is being redefined. So you'll find $200 tasting menus, but you might be sitting on a crate.
Here in Roberto's, next door to
exactly,
us.
Exactly,
right.
At Blanca. Okay. So that shape of the fine dining is changing.
But before I let Karen get her answer in, we're going to have to take a brief break. You're listening to Taste Matters, and we're celebrating our 100th episode by talking about trends in the let's say gastronomic and political implications of the food we eat. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.
It's hard to get my
She's dancing by herself in a mother's summer dress. Oh kid, she doesn't need your help.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
You are listening to Boy Crazy by Cookies here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. We are talking with Isabella Wojcik, the Director of House Programming at the James Beard Foundation and occasional guest host of Taste Matters itself, this very show, and Karen Karp, the President and Founder of Karp Resources, also a guest host throughout the last 100 episodes of Taste Matters. And before I let Karen answer the question that I asked in many parts and that has many sort of spidery ways to approach it, I'm going to remind people that you can call in, if you can get a word in edgewise, which is not a guarantee, to ask us questions at 718-497-2128. In fact, Nate Goldstein, my husband and partner, wanted to get acknowledgement as the best question answerer of the last 100 episodes and thought that he deserved a moment. So that's a shout out to Nate. And also you could, if you're listening to the podcast or you are listening to the archive or you just would rather write, you can send us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or even better and faster, you can tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. Karen, your turn.
So, Isabella, lots to unpack.
I don't know that I finished answering.
No, you didn't finish answering, but I'm going to try to get a word
in. But it's my show and we're going to stop, right? Yeah.
So, I'm going to kind of hopefully get to the conclusion of, or kind of the place of, back to the place of talking about democratization a little bit, because I think what we are talking about is, it could be described as democratization. I think it's more like everybody's at the table now. So I think that what I've been sort of thinking about the show and what we were going to talk about is that chefs are kind of at the forefront of creating trends and getting trends out. The media has done a fantastic job of elevating the stature of chefs to be stars. We all know that. And James Beard Foundation mm-hmm. had a lot to do with getting chefs on the map, so to speak, on the media map. And I think when chefs I think we are also a very casual culture in a way in the United States. We are friendly, gregarious, kind of, you know, open-hearted, open-minded people that kind of accept a lot of things. There's a democratization about that, like almost, that anything goes in a way. Mm-hmm. So I think that the trend that you were just talking about, such as El Bulli and Noma, have kind of, in a different way than it's normally used in restaurants, gotten chefs back into the weeds, but in a really good place. And so the extension of the interest in local food created an opportunity for chefs to get interested in who's making that local food. And so the producers of the food started to be elevated also into the spotlight. And I think that brings another sort of echelon of kind of a strata of a link along the food chain of that are part of this conversation now. So chefs and their food and the people that are making the food or growing the food or that they're asking to grow the food for them are in a more engaged conversation, and consumers are really interested in that. And I think because consumers got really interested in, like, who is that farmer and what is that variety and all that kind of stuff, they bring it back out to the other places where they're buying food. And they're buying food in supermarkets. Still 51% of the food that's consumed in this country is purchased in a retail store. So, I mean, restaurants obviously
and
are
mostly large supermarket chains. When you look at, I mean, Whole Foods may be part of our life and our day-to-day
Walmart.
Existence.
It's Walmart,
yeah, it's
baby.
Walmart and Costco and all.
Right.
It's not where we think we are going to find it. Yeah.
Exactly. And so once these ideas, trends, if you want to call them, or the kind of notion of that sort of inquiry into the where and the why and the who is making the food, which is the community part of what you talked about before, gets into that sort of mainstream sector, which some people are probably like, oh no, it can't be mainstream or it's going to get killed if it's mainstream. That's not my perspective. My perspective is when it's in the mainstream, it becomes a whole other conversation. And so what we're seeing now is that every single sector of the food industry is in the same conversation one way or another about what is provenance, what is quality, what is nutrition, what is flavor, what is taste. And all of these topics are coming together in the conversation of how is this going to define where the evolution of our food system or our food sector is going to in this country. It's a very exciting, thrilling time in a way, despite the fact that we know we have all these problems that we want to solve.
Right. Aren't we fortunate to be at this time in this? I mean, all of us have spanned other times, other periods, not as many as James Beard, let's say, who probably saw the starting point and the devolution, if we can say that, and the evolution to now. But you brought up something that I think is interesting and perhaps is a nice way on this auspicious day to frame the next set of questions. And that is, what do you think is uniquely American to our contributions in both of these areas? And I'm thinking both of the increasingly connected global world of chefs. You mentioned the influence of Noma and El Bulli, which... you know, there have been historically famous restaurants in other places, but not restaurants where you knew the second a dish was served that 700 people had tweeted it and suddenly let's look at the cronut has circulated the world. I landed in Japan and there were cronuts in Japan. And it's a function a little bit of the time we're in and the connectedness we have. So one hand, that's to you, Isabella, but also to you, Karen, this, what is the American piece of this, the contribution that we make to these larger global issues, whether gastronomic or political. And I'm thinking of a moment we had recently in Washington, D.C. with the Club des Chefs des Chefs, the chefs of the heads of state who were gathered as part of an organization in D.C. and our chef of the head of state, Sam Cass and Christetta Comerford, asked the question of the other chefs, do you get engaged in conversations about the food system or about the politics of where you are? And they all looked at him like he was crazy because, no, they cook for the heads of state. That's what their job is. And not to be this other, what seemed to me very American, you know, rallying activist in person with agency in the food system, even though you're just cooking dinner for the president. So who wants to start? Why don't we start with you, Karen?
Yeah, I mean, no one is just cooking dinner for a president. I mean, those dinners are documented. They are very strategically sourced and conceived and delivered. And, you know, we know when a meal is served in any kind of situation, but particularly in a very high level political environment, as social as it might be, it has import. And I think one of one of the components of this wonderful moment that we're in food is that we have Sam Cass and what his job is. His job is not just chef. His job is chief policy strategist. And he does that for the First Lady, who has very much used her unofficial but very important power to have conversations about what's happening with food in this country at very high levels. Highly controversial, of course, but highly impactful. And so I think going back, and everybody knows about it because of social media. You started the question about the impact of social media. I think the thing is with social media is you can't hide. Nobody can hide anymore, because if somebody or a company or a farmer or a chef or anybody does something that is against the sort of, you know, either bad, let's just say it's bad, for however you define bad, it's going to be out there in 43 seconds.
And used by some side to tell some story beyond what it was.
Exactly. Even. It certainly makes journalists' jobs very difficult. But we have so much access to so much information, and that snowball is building.
Sure. I will play the other side, which is I'm a little concerned about the effect of all of this information that surrounds us. We're certainly imagery driven, and Instagram is a perfect vehicle for that. Because there's just, you know, I feel like we're subject to whims. I think the power of suggestion is so much more forceful through social media, and then we're off and running without really thinking through what the ideas are. And the Cronut, I mean, it's a perfect example of that. I do feel like there are many other instances where food, where a technique, where a chef, where something is suggested, everyone wants to try it. But through social media, it snowballed into a frenzy. And now I'm feeling like there's trends, and then there's frenzy media moments. And I think the Cronut is a pivotal point in both.
And for those of you who don't, is there anyone who doesn't know who would listen to Heritage Radio what a Cronut is? We should just say that the Cronut is Dominique Ancel's merger of...
Famous pastry chef based in New York City.
Merger of the donut and the croissant, which he's trademarked and which people line up for hours and hours and hours and sell on the black market.
Which he clearly strategically thought about before he even, you know, finished testing the recipe. I saw a knockoff on 6th Avenue and 20-something Street just yesterday.
Oh my God, did you arrest them?
Knockoff, like, you know, big sign and a bakery. And I for a second I thought it was like selling Louis Vuitton bags, and then I realized it's Cronuts.
That's hysterical.
But I mean, it's funny because, you know, here, obviously the Cronut has tapped into something. It's very American, even just the conceit that you would take an American...
Eye rolling, right?
A donut and a croissant. You know, everyone's rolling over, literally and figuratively, about that. Put them together and create this mass trend. I mean, this thing, it's very of the moment. I think it's almost...
Here's what I also feel is of the moment. This idea of... the artisan and the artistry. And so when you're asking me about sort of and us as the, you know, what is American, what is our impact, you know, certainly certain regional food systems and how we've maybe immortalized them, like the South is a perfect example. I mean, I've referenced foraging in Noma, but really we're very much driven by Southern culture at the moment and Southern ingredients, which speaks to Southern stories, which speaks to, you know, mothers, women, gender, race, and the history of there. But those kinds of ingredients and techniques seem to be having a huge impact on the rest of the country. And that's one region.
Right. So I want to just immediately respond quickly to that. I mean, to some, I know that the sort of influence of Southern cuisine is a little bit like, when is it going to be over? And there's a lot of other things to appreciate.
Right.
But to the point that it does bring up a lot of things, particularly around race, it could be very interesting to see if one of the ways that Southern cuisine and chefs in the South can actually be one of an important factor in bridging a divide that still has a great need to be bridged here. Because if we are looking at a democratization of food, and we're looking at all the links along the chain kind of getting involved in provenance and quality and nutrition, et cetera, we still have this incredible divide in terms of the types of the consumers who are able to access that food. And unfortunately, it's significantly along racial lines. So as we're looking at the demographics of the country really shifting, and even, you know, even the future presidential candidates are going to be looking more, using the demographic information we have to understand what policies they should be putting together, I think the next frontier for chefs might really be to be on the forefront of helping, you know, helping create a little bit more equilibrium there, or equality.
And what a lovely place to stop. I realize one person who didn't get a word in edgewise was Ashley here, but I'm going to give her the last word, which is to tell people, well, first of all, thank you both for joining me. I hope that we'll have plenty of opportunity. Our listeners will have plenty of opportunity to listen to you. We're getting fan mail and texts as we write, people listening in Berkeley, California, and all sorts of places.
Early for them.
Yeah, it is.
Thank you.
So thanks for being here, but I'm going to give Ashley the last word to tell folks who's coming next week and what we'll be talking about.
Okay, I also wanted to point out that both Karen and Isabella, you can listen to the shows that they have hosted both on iTunes. Feel free to download them as a free podcast, as well as the HRN archives. And I'll be tweeting those throughout the week. So if you're like, I want to listen to something Isabella did, I'll be sure to tweet that and you should check it out. Next week, we are pleased to welcome Chef Seamus Mullen from Tertulia. And he wrote an excellent book called Hero Food that features lots of ingredients to kind of healthy, anti-inflammatory eating. And it's really exciting to have him on. And we're looking forward to it.
We will look forward to that. So in the next week before then, I want you to enjoy something and think about, I mean, this is what we often get people to think about, and I know it's a hard thing to hold in your head, but it's really important to, as you eat, to think about what brought that food there, what came to play to make it possible, whether you picked up some milk at the corner store and what's behind that, something Karen knows passionately about, the innovation that makes fresh milk possible to be everywhere, and the benefits and perhaps the negative aspects of that. And think about, spend a moment considering the flavor and think about the work that all of the people who really strive to improve not just the quality and the provenance of our food, but the taste of our food and the sorts of folks that Isabella deals with on a daily basis. And in doing that, you'll be ready to talk with Seamus next week. Thank you for listening.
Happy
Thank
anniversary, you. Mitchell.
Yes. Thanks.
100 episodes. Thank you.
Woo. Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.